A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one. He wants us to talk about the PT Cruiser, which he calls one of the most iconic cars in the US. And I think that framing right there is actually the most interesting part of this whole conversation. Because iconic is doing a lot of work. Is it iconic in the way the Mustang is iconic? Or iconic in the way a lava lamp is iconic? That tension between genuine design achievement and cultural punchline is basically the entire PT Cruiser story.
Oh, this is a fantastic topic. And before we dive in, quick note, today's script is being written by DeepSeek 5.4 Pro, so if I sound slightly different, that's why.
Alright, so where do we start? The numbers, I think, tell the opening chapter. The PT Cruiser launched in 2000 as a 2001 model, and Chrysler expected to sell about 70,000 units a year. First full year, they moved almost 145,000. Dealers were marking them up by thousands over sticker. People were getting on waiting lists. For a Chrysler.
Right, and that's the thing. This wasn't a sports car. It wasn't a luxury vehicle. It wasn't even a truck during the SUV boom. It was a front-wheel drive compact based on the Dodge Neon platform. The Neon platform, which was not exactly a source of automotive prestige. Brian Nesbitt was the designer. He was 27 years old when he sketched the thing. And he basically took the proportions of a 1930s gangster sedan, chopped the roof, gave it those bulging fenders, and somehow convinced Chrysler to build it.
The gangster sedan reference is interesting because that was actually part of the pitch. The PT originally stood for Plymouth Truck, by the way. It was supposed to be a Plymouth. Then the Plymouth brand got killed right as the vehicle was launching, so it became a Chrysler at the last minute. But the whole concept was this idea of blending retro hot rod styling with practical compact car packaging. A PT Cruiser was shorter than a Honda Civic of the same era, but had more interior cargo space with the seats folded. That's genuinely clever packaging.
The rear seats were removable entirely. Not just fold flat, you could take them out, and the front passenger seat folded forward flat to create a long load surface. So you could theoretically carry an 8-foot ladder inside a vehicle that was only 68 inches long. That's about 4.25 meters. The cargo flexibility was class leading, and the seating position was high, what they called command seating, so you felt like you were in something bigger than you actually were.
Which is a trick every crossover has been pulling for the last 2 decades. The PT Cruiser kind of invented that formula. The tall roof, the upright seating, the flexible interior, years before the crossover boom really took off. In a sense, every CR-V and RAV4 on the road owes a small conceptual debt to this weird little retro wagon.
The design language deserves real credit. Those double-cove door panels, the flared wheel arches, the chrome grille that looked like it came off a 1937 Ford, the interior had body-color painted metal panels on the dash. Not plastic pretending to be metal, actual stamped steel painted the same color as the exterior. The shifter was a cue ball on a stick. These were real design choices, not cost-cutting measures disguised as style.
I remember the cue ball shifter. That was the detail everyone pointed to in 2001 as proof that Chrysler understood fun. And for about 3 years, the PT Cruiser was cool. It won Motor Trend's Car of the Year for 2001. It was on magazine covers. Celebrities drove them. Chrysler couldn't build them fast enough. They added a second plant in Austria to handle European demand. The Graz facility built PT Cruisers for markets all over the world.
Then the problem set in. Chrysler didn't meaningfully update it for a decade. The PT Cruiser sold from 2000 to 2010 with essentially the same body panels, the same basic powertrain, the same interior design. The 2006 refresh was so mild most people couldn't tell the difference. Slightly different headlights, a revised grille, different taillights. That's about it. In automotive terms, a 10-year run without a major redesign is basically neglect.
The engine situation tells the whole story. At launch, the base engine was a 2.4-liter four-cylinder making 150 horsepower. That's fine for 2001, but by 2009, the base engine was still a 2.4-liter four-cylinder making 150 horsepower. Actually, the 2006 refresh dropped the base engine to 14.8 horsepower due to revised emissions tuning, so it got slower. Over a decade, the car got slower, heavier, and less competitive, while gas prices spiked and consumer tastes shifted.
The fuel economy was never good. The base automatic got about 21 miles per gallon city, 27 highway. That's roughly 11 liters per 100 kilometers in the city. For a compact car, a Honda Civic of the same era was getting 30 city, 38 highway. So you were paying a real penalty at the pump for that retro styling, and as gas hit $4 a gallon in the summer of 2008, that math got harder to justify.
There's a deeper story here about what happens when a design-driven product collides with operational reality. The PT Cruiser was heavy, around 3,100 pounds for the base model, which is about 1,400 kilograms. That's several hundred pounds heavier than a comparable Civic or Corolla. All those styling elements, the thick steel panels, the big doors, the heavy seats, added weight. And weight kills fuel economy. So the very things that made it distinctive were undermining its practicality as an everyday car.
Then there's the safety question. The Insurance Institute for Highway Safety tested the PT Cruiser in 2002. Frontal offset crash test, the PT Cruiser got a rating of acceptable, which is second best on their scale. Not great, not terrible. But the side impact test, when they finally did it in 2006, was rated poor without the optional side airbags. That's the lowest rating. And by that point, most competitors were getting good ratings as standard. The platform was aging, and safety standards were moving on without it.
Let's talk about the turbocharged version, because that's actually a bright spot in the engineering story. The 2003 GT model got a 2.4-liter turbocharged engine, same basic block, but with a turbo and intercooler, making 2.5 horsepower and 245 pound-feet of torque. That's a respectable output for the era. 0 to 60 in about 7. Not a hot hatch by any means, but quick enough to surprise people. And the 5-speed Getrag manual transmission in those GT models was actually pretty good. Tight throws, mechanical feel.
The GT also got a stiffer suspension, bigger brakes, and a slightly lower ride height. There was a small but real enthusiast community around the turbo models. People tuned them. The aftermarket developed engine management solutions. You could push that 2.4 turbo well past 300 horsepower with bolt-on modifications. There's still a PT Cruiser turbo subculture. Forums, meetups, the whole thing. It's niche, but it exists.
Which brings us to the strange second life of the PT Cruiser as a cultural object. At some point, probably around 2007 or 2008, the car transitioned from cool retro throwback to something people actively mocked. It became shorthand for bad taste. The wood-paneled special editions didn't help. The 2006 PT Street Cruiser Route 66 edition had solar yellow paint and literally said Route 66 on the side. It was like Chrysler was trying to make the uncoolness official.
The special editions are their own chapter of this story. There were over a dozen of them. The Flames package had actual flame decals from the factory. The Woody package had vinyl wood grain appliques on the doors, fake wood, not real, and it looked exactly as convincing as you'd expect. The Dream Cruiser series ran for 5 years and included colors like Inca Gold Pearl Coat and Electric Blue. There was a Pacific Coast Highway edition, a Street Cruiser Sunset Boulevard edition. Chrysler just kept layering nostalgia on top of nostalgia until the whole thing collapsed under its own thematic weight.
The Woody edition is where I think the PT Cruiser jumped the shark. The original car was inspired by 1930s coupes and sedans. The Woody was inspired by 1940s surf wagons. Those are two different retro references stapled together, and the result was, it was like a cover band playing two songs at once.
Yet. And this is what makes the PT Cruiser interesting. The sales held up surprisingly well for a surprisingly long time. In 2001, the first full year, Chrysler sold 144,717 units in the U.S. By 2005, that had dropped to 133,700, still over 100,000. In 2006, with the refresh, it actually bounced back to 108,600. The decline was gradual, not a cliff. Even in 2008, during the financial crisis and with gas prices soaring, they sold 67,000 units. The final year, 2010, they moved just under 21,000, so the market didn't suddenly reject the PT Cruiser. It just slowly lost interest.
The 2008 number is actually the most revealing. 67,000 units during the worst auto market in decades. That tells you there was a core audience that loved this vehicle. These weren't just people who couldn't afford something better. The PT Cruiser wasn't even that cheap by the end. A 2008 base model started around $16,000, but the well-equipped versions could push past $24,000. For that money, you could get a Honda CR-V or a Toyota RAV4, both of which were objectively better vehicles by almost any measure. So PT Cruiser buyers were choosing this car over better alternatives.
That gets at something important about the PT Cruiser's legacy. It wasn't a car you bought because it was the rational choice. It was a car you bought because you wanted it. The styling made you feel something. And for a certain kind of buyer, older, often, but not exclusively, that emotional appeal was worth the compromises in fuel economy, performance, and safety.
The demographic data on PT Cruiser buyers is fascinating. The average buyer age at launch was around 45, which is younger than you might expect. But by the mid-2000s, it had climbed past 55. Chrysler had intended the PT Cruiser to attract younger buyers to the brand, and initially it did. The car had genuine youth appeal in the early years. But as the design aged and the special editions got more nostalgic, the buyer base aged with it. By the end, it was almost exclusively purchased by people over 60.
There's a parallel here with the Volkswagen New Beetle, which launched in 1998 and followed almost the exact same trajectory. Huge initial demand, waiting lists, dealer markups, cultural phenomenon status, and then a slow decline as the novelty wore off and the underlying platform aged. The difference is that Volkswagen actually replaced the New Beetle with a second-generation model in 2011. Chrysler just let the PT Cruiser die.
That gets to the corporate story, which is maybe the most important part. Daimler-Chrysler, the merger of Daimler-Benz and Chrysler, happened in 1998, right as the PT Cruiser was being developed. The merger was supposed to create a global automotive powerhouse. Instead, it created a decade of underinvestment in Chrysler's product line. The PT Cruiser launched under Daimler-Chrysler and was essentially starved of development resources for its entire life. The Germans didn't understand the car, didn't see the point of investing in it, and by the time Cerberus Capital Management bought Chrysler in 2007, it was too late to do anything meaningful.
Cerberus owned Chrysler for about 2 years before the company filed for bankruptcy in 2009. The PT Cruiser was one of the vehicles that survived the bankruptcy restructuring. It was still selling enough to justify keeping the line running, but Fiat, which took over as part of the bailout, had no interest in developing a successor. The last PT Cruiser rolled off the assembly line in Toluca, Mexico, on July 9, 2010. Total production over the 10-year run was about 1.35 million units worldwide.
1.35 million. That's a lot of PT Cruisers. For context, that's more than the total production of the original Volkswagen Beetle convertible. It's more than the total production of the DeLorean DMC-12 by a factor of about 150. The PT Cruiser was, by any objective measure, a commercial success. It just wasn't a sustainable one.
The Toluca plant is worth mentioning because the build quality was. Early PT Cruisers from the Toluca plant had issues with paint quality, interior fit and finish, and electrical gremlins. The Austrian-built models for the European market, produced at the Magna Steyr plant in Graz, were generally regarded as better assembled. That plant also built the Mercedes G-Wagon and the BMW X3, so the quality standards were simply higher.
The reliability record overall is a mixed bag. 4-liter engine was actually pretty stout. There are PT Cruisers out there with over 200,000 miles on the original engine, but the automatic transmission, especially the 4-speed, was a weak point. Timing belt failures were common if owners didn't follow the replacement interval. The power windows failed regularly. The air conditioning systems had a tendency to leak. It was a Chrysler product of its era, with all the strengths and weaknesses that implies.
Let me circle back to something you said earlier about the crossover connection, because I think it's worth developing. The PT Cruiser was classified by the EPA as a light truck, not a passenger car. Chrysler deliberately got it classified that way to help meet corporate average fuel economy standards. The PT Cruiser's relatively poor fuel economy counted against a less stringent truck standard rather than the car standard. but that classification also meant the PT Cruiser was, legally speaking, a truck. And that allowed Chrysler to market it differently, to position it as this versatile, rugged lifestyle vehicle rather than just a tall hatchback.
That EPA classification trick is one of those things that sounds like a clever regulatory hack, but actually reveals a deeper truth about the vehicle. The PT Cruiser was a truck because it was heavy, upright, and prioritized cargo space over aerodynamics. It was a crossover before the industry had settled on the term crossover. The Honda CR-V launched in 1995, the Toyota RAV4 in 1994, but the PT Cruiser was the vehicle that brought the tall wagon concept to American buyers who would never have considered a Japanese import. It democratized the crossover silhouette.
Chrysler followed the PT Cruiser with the Chevrolet HHR in 2005, which was also designed by Brian Nesbitt, who had moved to General Motors. The HHR was essentially the same concept. Retro styling on an inexpensive platform, tall roof, flexible cargo area. But the HHR was based on the Chevy Cobalt platform and never captured the same cultural attention. It sold decently, about 100,000 units a year at its peak. But it was always seen as a PT Cruiser imitator, which is a strange thing to be when the original designer created both.
The HHR is the uncanny valley version of the PT Cruiser. Same designer, same idea, but everything is slightly off. The proportions are wrong. The retro reference is 1940 Suburban rather than 1930 sedan, and it just doesn't translate as well to a compact footprint. The interior was cheaper, the engine options were weaker, and the whole thing felt like a corporate memo turned into a vehicle. Which, to be fair, it kind of was. GM saw Chrysler selling 140,000 PT Cruisers a year and wanted a piece of that action.
The PT Cruiser also had a moment in popular culture that's worth cataloging. It appeared in dozens of movies and TV shows throughout the 2000s. It was in the Italian Job remake, the 2003 version, as one of the vehicles in the traffic jam sequence. It showed up in Breaking Bad. It was in countless music videos. For a period in the early 2000s, the PT Cruiser was the default vehicle for any production designer who wanted to signal that a character was slightly quirky but fundamentally suburban.
Then, around 2008, that same production design choice started meaning something completely different. The PT Cruiser became the car you gave to the character who was supposed to be out of touch. It went from signifying fun, approachable quirkiness, to signifying that someone was stuck in 2003. The cultural semiotics flipped without the vehicle changing at all. That's rare. Usually a product has to change for its cultural meaning to shift that dramatically.
There's a 2009 New York Times piece about this. The headline was something about the PT Cruiser's fall from grace. The article quoted owners who were defensive about their cars, who felt they had to explain their purchase to neighbors and coworkers. One owner said he'd started parking his PT Cruiser in the garage so people wouldn't see it. That's a remarkable thing. A vehicle going from status symbol to source of embarrassment in less than a decade without any major change to the product itself.
The Times piece is worth quoting directly because it captures the moment of transition. The article noted that by early 2009, PT Cruiser sales had dropped to about 4,000 units a month, down from over 12,000 a month at the peak. And the buyers who remained were described as fiercely loyal. Almost defensive. They'd formed online communities. They had PT Cruiser clubs. They organized meetups in parking lots where dozens of PT Cruisers would gather, often color-coordinated. It had become a subculture, not a mass-market product.
The PT Cruiser club phenomenon is interesting from a sociological perspective. These weren't car enthusiasts in the traditional sense. They weren't talking about horsepower figures and suspension geometry. They were decorating their cars. Flames, wood paneling, custom paint, interior modifications. The PT Cruiser became a canvas for personal expression in a way that few modern vehicles ever do. And that's partly because the retro styling invited customization. It already looked like a hot rod, so adding flames or pinstriping felt coherent rather than ridiculous.
It felt coherent to the people doing it. To everyone else, a PT Cruiser with factory flame decals was the visual equivalent of a dad wearing Oakley sunglasses indoors. But that judgment is itself interesting. At what point does enthusiastic self-expression become cringe, and who gets to decide?
The Flame DeKalb PT Cruiser is a perfect example of what happens when a manufacturer tries to co-opt a subculture and sell it back to the mainstream. Hot rodders had been putting flames on their cars for decades. It was an authentic expression of car culture. Chrysler saw that, thought we can sell that, and produced the Flames package. But factory flames aren't the same thing as flames painted by a guy in a garage. The authenticity is gone. And consumers can tell. They may not be able to articulate why it feels wrong, but they know it does.
The PT Cruiser ends up as this strange artifact of early 2000s American consumer culture. It was innovative in its packaging and design. It was a commercial success that sold over 1 million units. It created a new vehicle category that the entire industry eventually followed. And yet, it's remembered mostly as a punchline. The question is whether that's fair.
I think the answer is that it's partly fair and partly not. The PT Cruiser's design was a genuine achievement. Brian Nesbitt and the Chrysler design team created something that looked like nothing else on the road, that referenced automotive history without being a slavish reproduction, and that packaged interior space in a clever way. The problem was that Chrysler never backed up the styling with the engineering investment the vehicle deserved. The neon platform was adequate for 2001, but embarrassing by 2008. The engines were underpowered and inefficient. The interior materials got cheaper over time, not better. Chrysler harvested the PT Cruiser's success rather than reinvesting in it.
That harvesting strategy is the Daimler Chrysler story in miniature. The merger was supposed to create synergies. German engineering combined with American design and marketing. What actually happened was that Daimler extracted cash from Chrysler while starving its product development. The PT Cruiser got one refresh in 10 years. The Dodge Neon was replaced by the Caliber, which was worse. The Chrysler 300 launched in 2004 to rave reviews and then wasn't meaningfully updated for 7 years. The pattern was consistent. Launch strong, then neglect.
The 300 is actually a useful comparison to the PT Cruiser. Both were designed by young designers who were given unusual freedom. Ralph Gilles was in his early 30s when he led the 300 design. Both launched to enormous acclaim and strong sales. Both were allowed to wither on the vine. But the 300 had the advantage of a rear-wheel drive platform shared with Mercedes, which meant the driving dynamics were fundamentally sound even as the vehicle aged. The PT Cruiser had a neon platform. There was no amount of styling that could overcome that.
Let's talk about the PT Cruiser's place in automotive history. I think it deserves to be remembered as a design landmark, one of the most distinctive and influential vehicle designs of the early 2000s. It proved that styling could sell a car almost by itself. It anticipated the crossover boom by years. It showed that retro design, when done well, could create genuine emotional connection with buyers. Those are real achievements.
I'd add that it's also a cautionary tale about what happens when you don't follow through. The PT Cruiser could have been the foundation of a whole family of retro-styled Chrysler vehicles. Imagine a second-generation PT Cruiser on a modern platform with a hybrid powertrain, updated safety systems, and the same attention to interior flexibility. That vehicle could have been competitive into the 2020s. Instead, Chrysler let the nameplate die and replaced it with nothing.
Actually, they replaced it with the Chrysler 200, which was a mid-sized sedan so anonymous that most people couldn't pick one out of a parking lot. From the PT Cruiser to the 200, that's the arc of Chrysler's design ambition in the 2000s and 2010s. From a vehicle that made people feel something to a vehicle designed entirely to be inoffensive.
The 200 was essentially a rebadged Dodge Avenger, which was itself a thoroughly mediocre vehicle. It sold almost entirely to rental fleets. The contrast with the PT Cruiser, which people camped out to buy, couldn't be starker.
There's one more angle I want to explore before we wrap up, and that's the PT Cruiser's role in the broader retro design movement of the late 1990s and early 2000s. This was the era of the new Beetle, the Mini Cooper revival, the Ford Thunderbird retro reboot, the Chevy SSR. Automakers across the industry were mining their design heritage for inspiration. The PT Cruiser was part of that wave, but it was different in a crucial way. It wasn't reviving a specific model. It was evoking an era, not a nameplate. That gave it more creative freedom.
That's a really important distinction. The new Beetle had to look like a Beetle. The Mini had to look like a Mini. The PT Cruiser didn't have to look like any specific car, it just had to look like the idea of a 1930s American automobile. And that freedom is what allowed Nesbitt to create something that felt fresh even as it referenced the past. The PT Cruiser wasn't a copy of anything, it was a synthesis.
That synthesis worked because it wasn't just about exterior styling. The interior design, with the body color metal panels and the cue ball shifter and the high seating position, created a coherent experience. You sat in a PT Cruiser and it felt different from sitting in a Corolla or a Civic. It felt like an event, a small, inexpensive event, but an event nonetheless. Most economy cars don't feel like anything. The PT Cruiser felt like something.
The metal interior panels were a genuine risk, by the way. Most automakers cover interior metal with plastic because it's cheaper to mold plastic in complex shapes and easier to meet safety requirements. Exposed painted metal inside a car cabin means you have to worry about sharp edges in a crash, about heat transfer in direct sunlight, about noise and vibration. Chrysler's engineers had to solve real problems to make those panels work, and they did. That's not something a company does for a cost-cutting exercise. That's a commitment to a design vision.
That commitment paid off in the early years. The PT Cruiser won awards. It won comparisons. Car and Driver put it on their 10 best list. It was admired by the automotive press, which is not a group known for its affection for Chrysler products. The initial reviews were overwhelmingly positive. The criticism came later, as the vehicle aged and the competition improved and the novelty wore off.
The Car and Driver review from 2000 is worth recalling. They praised the steering feel, the ride quality, the interior space, and, of course, the styling. Their main criticisms were the engine's coarseness at high RPM and the fuel economy. Those criticisms would remain relevant for the entire production run.
All right, let's do a quick summary of the PT Cruiser's legacy, because I think there are four distinct threads here. Thread 1, design achievement. The PT Cruiser was an original piece of automotive design that influenced the entire industry. Thread 2, commercial trajectory. It launched as a phenomenon and then slowly declined as Chrysler failed to invest in updates. Thread 3, cultural arc. It went from cool to cringe without the vehicle itself changing, which tells us something about how cultural meaning works. Thread 4, corporate failure. The PT Cruiser's neglect was a symptom of Daimler Chrysler's broader mismanagement of the Chrysler brand.
That's a good framework. I'd add a fifth thread, the owners. The people who bought PT Cruisers, especially in the later years, weren't making a rational transportation decision. They were making an emotional choice. They loved the way the car looked and felt. And there's something almost admirable about that, choosing a vehicle that makes you happy even when Consumer Reports tells you to buy a Honda instead. The PT Cruiser owners' clubs are still active, by the way. There are still forums where people post photos of their customized PT Cruisers. The community didn't die when the production line stopped.
The used market for PT Cruisers is interesting, too. You can buy a clean, low-mileage example for under $5,000 now. For someone who needs a practical, versatile vehicle with character, that's actually a pretty compelling value proposition. The reliability issues are well documented, so you know what you're getting into. Parts are cheap and widely available. 4-liter engine is simple enough that most mechanics can work on it. In a world of increasingly complex and expensive vehicles, there's something to be said for a simple, characterful car that costs less than a used Honda Fit.
The Turbo GT models are the ones to get if you're actually shopping. The extra power transforms the driving experience, and the Getrag manual is enjoyable. A well-maintained GT with under 100,000 miles can be found for around $6,000 or $7,000. That's a lot of personality for the money.
That's probably the PT Cruiser's final act, transitioning from mass-market product to affordable enthusiast curio. The same trajectory as the original Beetle, the original Mini, the Citroën 2 CV. Vehicles that were designed as practical transportation, but became objects of affection. The PT Cruiser isn't in the same league as those cars in terms of historical significance, but the pattern is similar. First they're everywhere, then they're embarrassing, then they're rare enough to be interesting again.
We're in the interesting again phase now. I've started noticing clean PT Cruisers on the road and thinking not, oh no, but, that's actually kind of cool. The passage of time has been kind to the design. The things that seemed excessive in 2008, the bulging fenders, the chrome grille, the high belt line, now read as distinctive rather than dated. The crossover era has made the PT Cruiser's proportions seem normal rather than strange.
The crossover era has also made the PT Cruiser's fuel economy seem less damning. When every third vehicle on the road is a three-row SUV getting 80 miles per gallon, 24 combined from a compact doesn't seem so bad. The Overton window of acceptable fuel consumption has shifted.
The PT Cruiser was ahead of its time in offering a small vehicle with a commanding view of the road. That's now the default expectation for any crossover buyer. The PT Cruiser delivered that experience in a footprint smaller than a modern Civic. There's a genuine efficiency to the packaging that we've lost as crossovers have gotten larger and heavier.
Where does that leave us? The PT Cruiser was a bold design statement that captured a moment, sold over 1 million units, influenced an entire vehicle category, and then faded away due to corporate neglect. It's remembered as a punchline by people who haven't thought about it in 15 years, and it's remembered as a beloved vehicle by the people who actually owned and customized them. Both memories are real. Neither is the whole story.
Which is why Daniel calling it one of the most iconic cars in the US is actually a more interesting claim than it first appears. The PT Cruiser is iconic, but it's iconic in the way that a cultural artifact is iconic, not because it was the best at what it did, but because it was unmistakably itself. You can't confuse a PT Cruiser with anything else. In an industry where most vehicles are designed to be inoffensively anonymous, that's a real achievement.
Now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
In the 1910s, when European beekeepers introduced Italian honeybees to Madagascar, the imported bees adopted the local waggle dance dialect within a single generation, but the resulting hybrid communication system was slightly mistimed, causing foragers to consistently overshoot nectar sources by about 15 meters. Local beekeepers spent years baffled by why their hive seemed slightly incompetent before researchers figured out it was a translation error, not a navigation problem.
Right. The PT Cruiser story is really a story about what happens when a great idea meets indifferent execution over a long enough timeline. The idea was sound. The execution, for the first few years, was strong. But the indifference of Daimler Chrysler, and then Cerberus, and then the bankruptcy process meant the PT Cruiser never got the second act it deserved. We'll never know what a properly developed second generation could have been.
That's the open question I'll leave listeners with. If Chrysler had invested in the PT Cruiser the way BMW invested in the Mini, could it still be on the road today as a viable product? I think the answer is yes. The Mini has been through three generations now and still sells strongly. The formula, retro styling, premium interior, go-kart handling, still works. The PT Cruiser's formula, retro styling, flexible interior, affordable price, could have worked too with the right investment.
This has been My Weird Prompts. Thanks to our producer, Hilbert Flumingtop. If you enjoyed this episode, leave us a review wherever you get your podcasts. It helps other people find the show. I'm Korn.
I'm Herman Poppleberry. See you next time.
This episode was generated using Gemini Flash 3. Text-to-speech engine was Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too, from half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time, stay curious, keep weird in mind.